Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box.
Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, release stories, marketing stories, all those ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love, just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast, they lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try really hard not to do snark. I try really hard not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films manage to get made. Now, for those who downloaded version 1 of this podcast, I'd like to apologise for the even worse than usual audio on it. I have just re-recorded the opening, which is why it's running a little bit late. And so, without further ado, I'm going to get on with the first of the two films I'm covering in this episode of Film Stories. And for the first time ever, I'm doing a Star Wars movie. I've started with, one of the favourites? No, I'm not going to push that. Tell you what, let me play you a clip from the trailer from this 2019 adventure. We'll come to the story the other side of this.
It's an instinct. A feeling. The Force brought us together. We're not alone. Good people will fight if we lead them.
People keep telling me they know me. No one does.
But I do.
Long have I waited. And now, you're coming together. Is your undoing.
What are you doing there, 3PO?
Taking one last look, sir. At my friends.
Oh, that's sad, isn't it? It's the 2019 movie here, Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, directed by J.J. Abrams, screenplay credited to Abrams and Chris Terrio, story credited to Derek Connolly, Colin Trevorrow, J.J. Abrams, Chris Terrio, characters by George Lucas, and a cast led by the late Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, Adam Driver, Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, Oscar Isaac, Anthony Daniels, Naomi Aki, Donald Gleeson, Richard E. Grant, Lupita Nyong'o, Kerry Russell, Kelly Marie Tran, Ian McDermott, Billy Dee Williams, amongst the extensive ensemble for a much, much look forward to film. Now, because I've not done Star Wars before on Film Stories, I'm just going to rewind just slightly, because the road to 2019 Star Wars movie was actually set all the way back in 2012. That's when the film was first mentioned. But crucially, for the purposes of this tale, it was also when George Lucas decided to cash out. He sold his Lucasfilm empire to Disney, a deal worth $4 billion. He had more money than me. I couldn't afford to rival that. A real surprise deal when it was announced as well, really seen as a coup for Disney. And I think even though it's had problems with Star Wars since, I mean, financially, it's more than paid off, even if creatively there have been some bumps in the road. But for a long while, it all worked. It was all announced in October of 2012, and Disney took little time at all in setting its ambitions, because the same month it concluded its secret deal to buy Lucasfilm, it announced new Star Wars films. The new Lucasfilm was going to be headed up by Kathleen Kennedy, hired for and lured away from Steven Spielberg, and a release date for 2015 was confirmed, really, for the first of this brand new trilogy of Star Wars movies that George Lucas for a long time had teased doing a sequel trilogy to the six Star Wars films he'd made so far. Now Disney was going to pick up the mantle, really, and do that. Without his involvement, he would have to console himself with more money than any human being could possibly spend in their lifetime. Within a month of the announcement, details were hitting the trade press about just how this trilogy was going to pan out. Now, Michael Arndt was the first writer to be hired, but he was hired for Star Wars Episode 7. In 2012, though, 7 years ahead of Episode 9, we knew possibly the identity of one of the writers, that both Lawrence Kasdan and Simon Kinberg were hired by Lucasfilm to write the next two chapters. Now, we didn't know who was going to do Episode 8, which was due in 2017, who was going to do Episode 9 in 2019. We just knew that Lawrence Kasdan, who has lots of form with the world of Star Wars, of course, and Simon Kinberg rising high off the back of producing the X-Men films, amongst many other films of 20th Century Fox, they were going to write the next films. Who was going to take what was unclear. They're also set to produce them as well. There was a talk of a writer's room to come together to sort out the long-term plot of the trilogy before they really got going. In what would turn out to be something of a fatal error, really, they didn't go in that direction in the end. And so while there was a plan for what this inverted commas Skywalker trilogy was going to be, there wasn't actually a start, middle and end fully mapped out once they got going. And I think Disney was to have its time again, that might be the kind of thing it might want to course correct. Plans for the Star Wars films did go off in slightly different directions, and the emphasis would move to Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Lawrence Kasdan would come in and work on the script once Michael Arndt had delivered his draft of that. And so the focus really went on to that. But there was talk also of just side movies outside of this trilogy, and it soon became clear that Disney was going to be looking to releasing a Star Wars film every year. One year we'd get part of this trilogy, another year we would get a spin-off, a slightly different film just within the Star Wars universe. By 2014, personnel for later chapters were starting to come together as well, because by this point, J.J. Abrams had been hired to go behind enemy lines, having directed two Star Trek films, and bring Star Wars back to the big screen as director. And Rian Johnson, primarily I'd suggest off the back of his terrific sci-fi movie Looper, was announced in June 2014 as the writer and director of Star Wars Episode 8. Now, what was interesting about this announcement was, as part and parcel of it, the Hollywood trades were suggesting he would be penning the story treatment for Episode 9 as well. It was also confirmed up front, Rian Johnson won't be directing Episode 9, but he will have involvement in which way the story was going to go. So the plan was that there would, again, be connective tissue between the films, that they wouldn't be reactive to each other. There would be at least some longer-term, broader planning. Episode 7 had originally been planned to come out in the summer of 2015. It was going to be the big movie of that summer as well. But an assortment of delays. I mean, it takes a long time to get a Star Wars Empire moving, not least negotiating with the British government for tax breaks so that the Star Wars films could be based here in the UK. Those tax breaks were sorted, which is why the then Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK, a very popular man by the name of George Osborne, is thanked in the end credits for on Episode 7. But the deal that the government struck with Lucasfilm and Disney has held ever since. And so Star Wars still finds the UK, for its films at least, one of its key homes. Instead of Star Wars Episode 7 in the summer of 2015, though, the big movie of that particular summer season turned out to be the long-awaited reboot of the Jurassic Park films. The fourth Jurassic Park movie, called Jurassic World, came out summer 2015, penned by Derek Connolly and Colin Trevorrow, with Colin Trevorrow directing. And what a jump for him. Trevorrow got the Jurassic World job off the back of a terrific film, Safety Not Guaranteed, a tiny budget science fiction movie, and then he's making the biggest film of the year. Jurassic World would go on to gross over $2 billion at the global box office. And Trevorrow's reputation was through the roof off the back of that. He'd made the small indie film and really delivered. He made the big blockbuster and really delivered as well. And this got the attention of Lucasfilm. And so in August of 2015, with Universal still counting up the money from Jurassic World, and it was pouring in, it was announced that Colin Trevorrow was going to be the director of Star Wars Episode 9, with Derek Connolly joining him on scripting duties. It wasn't going to be the next film Colin Trevorrow was going to direct, and it pretty much knocked him out of making Jurassic Park 5, or Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, as it would be known, that Trevorrow and Connolly would work on the script for that. But the director's chair would be handed over to a previous guest on this very podcast, Juan Antonio Bayona. In fact, Trevorrow talks about it in a podcast special we did with him as well for the next Jurassic World film, Jurassic World Dominion. But for the purposes of this story, Trevorrow and Connolly got to work on a script. The draft called, it was known as Duel of the Fates, named after John Williams' superb piece of music from Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. And we know that by the end of 2016, a script had been completed, at least one draft, probably more drafts actually. But Trevorrow had a passion project that he was in the midst of filming at this point and really wanted to get made, that he'd gone from a tiny movie to a huge movie, and now he was going to a smaller film again, a drama thriller called The Book of Henry. The script that Trevorrow and Connolly delivered at the end of 2016 had the character of Leia still in the saga. The tragic death of Carrie Fisher meant that the inclusion of that character was seen as not going to be possible at the end of 2016. In fact, there was talk of rewriting the script just to remove Leia from the film at that stage. We'll come back to her shortly. But in the end, it wouldn't be Colin Trevorrow who'd take Episode 9 over the line. That rhymes. Because when The Book of Henry came out, it would be fair to say it got absolutely savage. Now, it was a Universal movie. I mean, it made billions for Universal. Why wouldn't Universal gamble $10 million on a drama? Thing is, the reviews were hostile and the film grossed under $5 million at the global box office. And all of a sudden, Colin Trevorrow, in Disney and Lucasfilm's eyes, was not quite as bulletproof as he was before. He'd gone from tiny success to huge hit to an apparent flop. And this was set against stories too of things reportedly not going well. I'm going with allegedly because conflicting reports on this. What disagreements behind the scenes of Star Wars. Now, this was becoming slightly more regular at this point, that by this stage, Disney had released the Episode 7 in 2015, $2 billion, huge success. 2016's Rogue One, directed by Gareth Edwards, it was very well known that Tony Gilroy had come in towards the end of that film, and Gareth Edwards had, I mean, by reading the stories, been sidelined somewhat, and it was the first sign that maybe Lucasfilm had a problem with movie directors. I mean, it was hiring Josh Trank to make a Star Wars movie. We'll mention him just again very, very shortly. And in the midst of all of this, Trevorrow, well, there was talk that maybe he was going to part ways with Lucasfilm as well. And so a statement came out in September 2017 to confirm these very rumours that Variety reported it was over difference of opinion of the script for episode 9. The official statement was just all very chummy and happy. Lucasfilm and Colin Trevorrow have mutually chosen to part ways on Star Wars episode 9. The statement read, Colin has been a wonderful collaborator through the development process, but we have all come to the conclusion that our visions for the project differ, which was proven later down the road, but we'll come to that as well. We wish Colin the best and will be sharing more information about the film soon. This was not a lie. More information was forthcoming. But even a few weeks before that, there were clues that all perhaps wasn't perfect when Jack Thorne, British screenwriter, brilliant British screenwriter, had been hired to come in and take a look at the screenplay that Trevorrow and Connolly were working on. And then also earlier that summer, a pair of directors, Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, had been given the heave-ho from another Star Wars movie, Solo, a Star Wars story. That was something of a shock because Solo, shoot, had nearly completed. I will deal with it in a separate episode at some point, I'm sure. But the fact that it'd been allowed to get, what, two-thirds through production before Disney decided to hit the ejector seat on Lord and Miller was alarming, really, from us from the outside looking in. I mean, it's not my money, but it just didn't seem like it was a particularly coherent and happy setup that was going on behind the scenes there. A safe pair of hands, of course, was brought in to bring Solo to the screen. That would be Ron Howard. It didn't quite work out there. But here now, the narrative was turmoil, that you had Rogue One stories. Josh Trank would depart his Star Wars film without getting to make it as well. I mean, Stephen Daldry was linked to one at one point as well. Miller and Lord would have, of course, the last laugh, that they would go off to channel their energies into a different film, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which would be a huge box office success and win them Oscars, all the while Solo was struggling at the box office. But going back to Jack Thorne being brought in, when he was hired to work on Star Wars Episode 9, and Trevorrow was still on the project at that point, that's where the rumours really started to build. And as the Hollywood Reporter wrote at the time, it said, sources say that the working relationship between Colin Trevorrow and Lucasfilm head Kathleen Kennedy became unmanageable. Kennedy, who, again, if you dig into the archive, there's an episode where we talked to her, had already been through one director firing replacement on the Han Solo spin-off movie. She was not eager for a sequel and tried to avoid this decision. But it became clear it was going to be an inevitability. Lucasfilm and Trevorrow were not seeing eye to eye and a change was going to be made. Lucasfilm also knew once you've made the change, you've got to bring in the replacement quickly. It's like when your football team's in trouble and you sack the manager, you need to have the next one lined up. And so somewhat inevitably, Rian Johnson, who at that stage was deep in post-production on episode 8, and J.J. Abrahams were listed as possible replacements. Now, Johnson had a project by the name of Knives Out, you might have heard of it, that he was also noodling, and he wasn't really a candidate for episode 9 as I understand it. I might be wrong, I wasn't in the room. J.J. Abrahams absolutely was, and within a month of Colin Trevorrow being announced as leaving episode 9, J.J. Abrahams was confirmed as coming back. Not only was he going to direct the film, he was going to write it with Chris Terrio as well, and a December 2019 release was confirmed. Finally, the turmoil on episode 9 looked like it was done. And Abrams had started this saga off, you would assume he'd have an idea of where it was going to end. Disney put its energies on getting The Last Jedi into cinemas, and it did really well at the box office, $1.3 billion. But what it didn't do was Force Awakens levels of numbers. It was down significantly on that, but still reporting the kind of box office returns that anyone would be happy with, really. Grossed more than Rogue One had done the year before, and so it was kind of hard to gauge just if Disney was happy with that. But narratively, it would prove to be a far more divisive film. Even if you take away the toxic extremes of fandom, there were decisions made in The Last Jedi that pleased some, that didn't please others, not least what happened right at the start. And, I mean, it sort of hinted to the fact that there wasn't a through-line narrative going through this trilogy that was linking everything up. In fact, in hindsight, many of the actors involved would talk about this more openly. They wouldn't do it in the midst of filming it, of course. But what The Last Jedi also did was it turned some of it. I mean, it gave a drum to beat for the particularly hostile elements of fandom. There's a lot of constructive debate, as always, in and around the world of Star Wars. If you go to the very, very edges, let's just say some of the debate is less constructive. And fandom was becoming hostile towards Lucasfilm and also towards, in small numbers, really, but loud numbers, Rian Johnson as well. Colin Trevorrow would talk to Empire magazine in 2018, and he would, I mean, he gave a very, very upbeat statement and reading of his time at Lucasfilm. And he said, "I got the opportunity to tell a story that is a celebration of everything I believe in." He said, "I got to tell it to George Lucas and I got to tell it to Luke Skywalker. And these are experiences I will cherish for the rest of my life." While he was getting ready to move back into the world of Jurassic World with Jurassic World Dominion, the cast was confirmed for Star Wars Episode 9 by Disney in a press release in July 2018. Quite a lot of the names on that cast list were not surprises. We knew Daisy Ridley was coming back, and Adam Driver, John Boyega, Oscar Isaac, Lupita Nyong'o, Donald Gleeson, Kelly Marie Tran, Juno Suetamo, and Billy Lord. Now, Billy Lord, of course, Carrie Fisher's daughter, a significant addition to the cast of the movie. And then joining the saga were Naomi Ackie, Richard E. Grant and Kerry Russell, who'd been rumoured for a little while at this point. It was also confirmed that original trilogy stars Mark Hamill, Anthony Daniels and Billy Dee Williams were coming back for the new movie as well. One piece of casting that did not pan out, though, was in August 2018. This was a month after Disney issued that press release. Matt Smith, he of the TARDIS and Time Lord extraordinaire, was said to be landing, quote, a key role in the new Star Wars film. But for whatever reason, that didn't come to pass. I mean, by this stage, he jumped onto the Terminator saga. That didn't quite work out. Now, the script that the cast were originally sent for Episode 9 was said to be rather different from the one that they'd come to film. And I'll come to that shortly. But also with the announcement that Disney put out in July 2018, there was that confirmation that Carrie Fisher would not be replaced. And as J.J. Abrams said in the press statement, "We desperately loved Carrie Fisher. Finding a truly satisfying conclusion to the Skywalker saga without her eluded us. We were never going to recast or use a CG character. With the support and blessing from her daughter, Billy, we found a way to honour Carrie's legacy and role as Leia in Episode 9 by using unseen footage we shot together in Episode 7. Now, there was a little implication just in that story of some of the, well, a hint more than an implication of some of the pushback that Disney and Lucasfilm had had for including a CG recreation of a character in Rogue One. I won't go on to spoil it if you've not seen it. Just save to say, an actor who is no longer with us, they were suddenly acting in front of their eyes, and it just felt, to my eyes at least, a little bit ooky and not quite right. August the 1st, 2018, filming finally began on Star Wars Episode 9, which we didn't know yet that was going to be called The Rise of Skywalker, but was The Rise of Skywalker. In fact, the book that would come out, The Art of Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, would dig into just some of the challenges of making this particular Star Wars film, because it quotes Chris Terrio in there. Now, Terrio, a screenwriter, wrote the brilliant Argo, also worked on Justice League, so knows a fair amount of turmoil behind the scenes. It was Business Insider who quoted him in relation to that book as saying, "I've never rewritten a film as much as this one." He said, "It's like a tide. There's a new script every morning, but we just keep going at it and going at it, loosely thinking that it's not good enough. It's never good enough." And it hinted that the script to this film that was effectively announced in 2012 was in some degree of continual flux. And as Terrio said, luckily the production team is so good that they can shift and adjust, and no one's arguing about the skill of the Star Wars production team. But Terrio said, "We're course correcting as we go. We're trying things, and some things don't work, and some things aren't ambitious enough. Some things are overly ambitious. Some things are too dense. Some things are too simple. Some things are too nostalgic. Some things are too out of left field." He said, "We're finding our balance." And there's an argument when the final version of the film came out, they never really did manage to find that balance. But I will come back to that shortly. Now, Carrie Fisher's daughter did play her mother in a flashback scene with Luke Skywalker. Other than that, it was footage previously shot of Carrie Fisher that was used in the film. And J.J. Abrams now directing his second Star Wars movie, but also, as far as Disney was concerned, this was the fifth one under its watch, was a little more open than he'd been on Episode 7. Episode 7 was a huge event. Just the mere existence of it was gigantic. The first new Star Wars film in 10 years that was going to be. And the veil of secrecy over the new trilogy was intense. This time he was a little more open, and he would reflect on that in an interview with UpRox, and he just said, "I feel very confident about what the movie is." He said, "I feel like we found a way to do something that doesn't need, and I don't feel the need, to do smoke and mirrors at all on this." It's worth noting that Abrams was burned a little bit on this on his second Star Trek movie, Star Trek Into Darkness, where everyone protected a secret in the build-up to the film's release that just didn't look like a secret at all. And in doing so, I mean, you'd have to say they kind of flat out lied, really. And I understand why they did, but the experience of that had gone into lots of people's heads, and I'd imagine Abrams was one of them. He said, "I feel we have a story that's pretty huge in scope. While I don't want to tell the whole movie to people and ruin it, and I don't want to spoil things," he did admit, "I feel like we need to be able to have a conversation about how, yeah, Carrie Fisher appears in this movie, and I'm happy to talk about how we did it, in so much as people know it's really her, that we didn't do a digital Carrie." He said, "Yes, Palpatine is in the movie. I don't want to talk about what that is and how." But he said, "I'm not unguarded because I want to make sure people enjoy the experience when they go. But I feel about this movie a little more open, I guess, than I have before." Well, the whole thing was nearly a lot more open, as it turned out, because the script for Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, as it wasn't yet known, would actually leak out. That it was only reported by Entertainment Weekly just ahead of the release of the film that there was a moment where one of the actors in the film left the screenplay under their bed in their accommodation. It was found, as J.J. Abrams explained, by someone who was cleaning their place, and it was given to someone else who then went to sell it on eBay. Now, my understanding on Star Wars films is you have to be one of the lead actors to be able to take the screenplay away, but my lawyers do not allow me to point fingers on this, so I won't. I will just say the whole thing's obviously clearly made up, because that way I can't get sued. That notwithstanding, the screenplay did go on eBay. Loads of fakes go on eBay, and the number of fakes probably helps obfuscate, really, the fact that the real one's on there. And so Disney just set up an account and quietly bought it and took the script and just reverted it back to its original owner. A whole leak of just where the film was going to go was averted just by a little bit of quick eBay purchasing. It was February 2019 then that the end of production came, and the price tag apparently came in at, get this, $416 million. $416 million. To give you some context, I mean, that would buy you 8 GoldenEyes, for instance. It's that level of scale. To this day, Episode 9, I'm recording this in 2024, remains one of the most expensive films of all time. $416 million to make one feature movie. Post-production was a bit more of a race than Abrams had on Episode 7. Going back to that film, if you remember, the film was delayed from the middle of the year to the end. Here, it was locked to a release date. And Abrams said, "We always knew we were going to have 3 fewer months to post-production this film." There was going to be reshoot work as well, and there duly was. But he did say, as much as it's still being worked on, it's literally a practical race to get it finished. He said, "We had more reshoots on Episode 7 on this one." He said, "We had more story adjustments on 7 than this one. We didn't know if these characters would work, if these actors would be able to carry a Star Wars movie." He said, "There were lots of things we didn't know. And on this, we knew who and what worked. And everyone is doing the best work I've ever seen anyone do." Just the kind of thing you'd say in the build-up to the release of the film. A few days later, he'd be saying slightly different things. Abrams said, "The ambition of this movie is far greater than Force Awakens. What we set out to do was far more challenging, and everything is exponentially larger on this. $416 million. In April 2019, 3 months after production had wrapped up, the first trailer came out. Star Wars trailers always massively anticipated, this one no different at all. And that's when we learnt that the title of the film was going to be The Rise of Skywalker. And fandom united, it came together and just said almost all in one. So what? I mean, a fairly bland title, but a title doesn't make the movie. I remember when Attack of the Clones was announced as a title, that title didn't go down well, and look how the film, let's move on. 2019, but also, I should point out that The Mandalorian, the first big, the first television spin-off that Disney had done of Star Wars, was out to strong reviews, that was going well. In fact, there was an argument after the financial disappointment of Solo, it was going better on television than the Star Wars saga was going on the big screen. But the test of that would be when the movie went in front of audiences, that it was set for release, the premiere December 16th 2019. My favorite about this, the press screening for Star Wars Episode 9 The Rise of Skywalker took place in the UK just a day or two before release, and the film was finished reasonably late, but also they wanted to protect spoilers for those without an eBay account. But also at the same time, the film Cats, covered before on this podcast, had just been finished too, and there was time for one big press screening of both. And in the UK, those press screenings took place on the same night. And so picture the scene, all these poor movie critics having to run from Cats right across town at speed to settle down for The Rise of Skywalker. What a double bill that turned out to be. The critical response to The Rise of Skywalker, I mean, it wasn't awful, but it just wasn't great either. Even before we get to the audience response, I mean, it just felt safe. That was generally what most were saying. There was a lot of criticism at Episode 7 for all the spectacle. It was retreading previous ground. Episode 8, whether you like it or not, took a swing. This felt like it had responded to a lot of the criticism of Episode 8 and gone back to a very, very safe place. That it wasn't without strengths. There's stuff in Episode 9 that's there to like. But also, it didn't take long for the growing narrative to come out that maybe Phantom Menace was better than this. Maybe Rise of Skywalker was just an absolutely safe end to, I mean, a nine film saga, a trilogy of trilogies that had begun all the way back in the 1970s. It was supposed to conclude all of that. It just felt damn. Well, metaphorically and actually, it just felt a bit damn. Still, Star Wars films had come up against poor and middling critical responses before, and it didn't stop them being a hit. And guess what? Didn't stop it being a hit. That the opening in the US took place December the 20th to the 22nd is the weekend that Star Wars Episode 9 landed $177 million. We weren't at Force Awakens levels even, crikey. But this was still a massive, massive film. And there were other films doing quite nicely around at that point as well. That Jumanji The Next Level had come out the week before and was on $26 million on its second weekend. Star Wars Episode 9 was number one by a lot. Cats, meanwhile, poor Cats, $6.6 million, opened in fourth place. Knives Out from Rian Johnson was doing nicely, thank you very much. A far more modestly costed production that was about to go over $100 million. Frozen 2, it was out for Disney. That had been out for 5 weeks and was closing in on $400 million by the time Star Wars turned up. This was the year that Disney had, what, 7 films that crossed $1 billion at the global box office. The hits kept coming. Star Wars would be one of them. But The Rise of Skywalker's second weekend take was down 60%. Now, what's interesting about this is that took in the Christmas weekend in the US, and lots of other big films were increasing their box office take. Jumanji's box office went up 33% as it went over that Christmas period. Star Wars went down 60%. Frozen 2 went up 30%. Knives Out went up 51%. Even Richard Jewell, the Clint Eastwood drama, went up 18%. Star Wars wasn't holding the audience that Disney had hoped and expected. And the pushback was beginning reasonably quickly. As it headed into early 2020, I mean, the film was still number one for on its third week with $34 million in its third weekend out. I mean, it was closing in on $500 million just in the US very quickly. In the end, though, it was 1917 that knocked it off the top of the chart in under a month. And if you go back to the blanket dominance of Episode 7 when that launched, this was a very different story. Still, 550 million in the US, 558 million outside of the US, a worldwide gross of $1,074,000,000. That's a fair amount of change, but notably that the trend here was decline, that the trilogy, each chapter in that trilogy made less money. And that's not the way modern cinema was supposed to go. If you take episode 7 as something of a freak just by the sheer novelty of it, the thinking was episode 9 should have increased box office. But here, there was clearly a problem. J.J. Abrams would do a Q&A a couple of days after the release of the film, and he would talk to Vanity Fair, who asked if fans aren't getting something from the final film in this franchise. And, you know, is there something to their complaints? And Abrams said, no, I'd say that they're right. There are people who love it more than anything are also right. But he was acknowledging and very aware that there was a kind of, well, was that what we all waited for? Feeling to the end of the movie. And I mean, it would be a couple of years really before he was more open. I mean, actors have been far more vocal. John Boyega has been very, 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 very interesting on his thoughts on where Star Wars kind of just went away from what he thought he was going to do. He's not alone there. In the case of J.J. Abrams, it would be 2 years later before he talked to Collider, and he'd just say, you have to plan things as best you can, and you always need to be able to respond to the unexpected. And the unexpected can come in all sorts of forms. And I do think there's nothing more important than knowing where you're going. We're back to that critical error right at the start. Having a plan, he said, I've learned, in some cases the hard way, is the most critical thing. Because otherwise you don't know what you're setting up. You don't know what to emphasise. Because if you don't know the inevitable end of the story, you're just as good as your last sequence or effect or joke or whatever. But you want to be leading to something, something inevitable. And it just didn't happen. He didn't outright acknowledge it, but it just seemed to be the confirmation that when they started all this in 2012, at the very least, where they thought they were going to end up was not where they ended up. Now, filmmaking is discovery. I get that. Still, to not have a vague target of what this had to do by the end just felt a little bit odd, if that was indeed the case. I should just put in a quick word for the Duel of the Fates script here as well, because in the aftermath of The Rise of Skywalker's release, there were questions asked about what direction Colin Trevorrow's version of this would take. And his script was leaked online to a middling reception, really, but interesting. And then Disney was just kind of left with a bit of a puzzle, because whilst it was enjoying a lot of success with Star Wars on its now Disney Plus streaming service, Andor in particular is the one, and along with The Mandalorian, every subsequent attempt, and we're 6 years, nearly, well, 5 years on nearly from The Rise of Skywalker at the point of recording, every subsequent attempt to get a film off the ground, a Star Wars film off the ground, has stumbled. Patty Jenkins had a go. The Game of Thrones team had a go. Kevin Feige was going to have a go. Taika Waititi was going to have a go. There were all these names linked with Star Wars films, and the one thing we didn't end up with was a Star Wars film. And in fact, we're at the point here, it's these 4.5 years since we saw The Rise of Skywalker. Now we're at a point where it looks like we will get a new Star Wars film in 2026, a Mandalorian movie. And that's what, 7 year gap. Such was really just the way that these Star Wars films in the end failed to ignite in the way Disney hoped. And whilst it's not as dramatic as an example, really, it does remind me a little of when Batman and Robin came out in 1997 and lost a good chunk of fandom, and that Warner Brothers just had to wait it out and bring Christopher Nolan in once a period of time had passed. Disney's been able to mitigate this with a whole lot of successful television outings, and so it's not hurt its bottom line that much. And also the $4 billion purchase price, still, however you want to stack it up, looks like an absolute bargain. But The Rise of Skywalker, a really odd footnote to a groundbreaking saga of films, even the prequel series trilogy, groundbreaking saga of films, just really odd that it ended so safely. And that brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. I'm hopelessly overrunning already, so I'm going to do my parish notices very quickly. If you like this podcast, would you please mind just doing one or two little things that could just help support it other than listening to it? I thank you for listening to it. I really appreciate that enormously. If you could subscribe to it, your podcast home of choice, that would be wonderful. I'd really love that. And it really helps with algorithms and stuff like that for those of us without money to pay to promote our podcast. Likewise, if you can leave ideally a hugely positive review, that's massively appreciated. If you want to put money in the Film Stories pot, if you go to patreon.com/Simon Brew, you can get the podcast early and ad-free and ideally audio working free most weeks. There you also find the gossip of what we're up to behind the scenes. And then I've got print magazines coming out. Issue 50 of Film Stories magazine I'm about to announce. I'm so excited about the cover star. I've also got issue 17 of Film Junior about to go live too. I am absolutely knackered making these print magazines, but I passionately believe in them. You can find them at store.filmstories.co.uk. But because I'm hopelessly overrunning, I'm going to end the Paris notices there. I'm going to move on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. We're going forward to 2024, actually. Let me play you a clip from the trailer of this one. I'll come to the story, the other side of this.
Before we start, do you have insurance?
What?
Your coverage good? Like, you have dental?
Oh, haha.
Is there a hospital nearby? Is it, like, too far?
It's about, like, 25 minutes, I'd say.
I just slapped you. Are you all right?
What?
So you like to fight? You ever win?
No one ever wins a fight.
This ain't the Holiday Inn, pal.
I am. I'm moving.
A friend of mine suggested I come talk to you. I own a roadhouse out in the Florida Keys. Lately, it's been attracting the wrong clientele. I can pay you good money. Judging by your car, you need that.
Well, I like my car.
Think about it.
That then was a clip from Roadhouse, the 2024 version, directed by Doug Liman. Screenplay credited to Anthony Bagarozzi and Charles Mondry. They're credited with the story as well, along with David Lee Henry, based on the original film Roadhouse by David Lee Henry and Hilary Henkin, and starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melchior, Billy Magnussen, Jessica Williams, Joaquin de Almeida, Conor McGregor making his acting debut in the midst of this as well. So it was all the way back actually in 2013 that the first rumblings began of a new take on the much loved Patrick Swayze headlined violence fest Roadhouse. A real 1980s favourite, this, directed by someone with an amazing name, Rowdy Herrington. That would be my name if I was reborn. And I mean, by 2013, it was one of a bunch of MGM films that was being talked about for a remake. So this was MGM after it had just come out of its latest financial strife. And so the idea was, let's look through the archive. Let's see what else we could possibly remake. Let's see what names we own that we can do something with. So the new take on RoboCop was moving roughly around this time, for instance. And in November 2013, The Hollywood Reporter broke the news that a new take on Roadhouse was now happening. Michael Stokes was hired to write a screenplay for the film, and Rob Cohen of The Fast and the Furious was set to direct. Now, Cohen hasn't actually directed now since 2018's The Hurricane Heist, following serious sexual abuse allegations, which he denies. But at this stage, he'd just made The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, and he'd made the ill-fated first movie based on the Alex Cross novels as well. That didn't go very well, so there wasn't a second movie based on them either. But Roadhouse was going to look like his next project once he was done doing a film for Jason Blum and his Blumhouse production company, and that was the thriller The Boy Next Door, starring Halle Berry. So in the midst of filming that, the thinking was, then move on to Roadhouse. But for whatever reason, it kind of trickled out. And then the next we heard was September 2015. So the story's already moved on a year or two. And fresh personnel had moved in by this point. Now it was UFC fighter Ronda Rousey who was going to headline the new Roadhouse. This gave all the indication of a page one reset for the remake. So whatever had been done before by Rob Cohen and Michael Stokes didn't look like it was carrying over. Neither was taking credit into the eventual version of the movie we saw. And so MGM at that stage was keen to get Ronda Rousey on board, one of the most successful UFC fighters and a real big name, really. And the idea of getting her to headline a movie, well, that was a bit of a coup. So get her on board, then go out to screenwriters to see who could turn this into a workable project. Then the plan at that point was to get the film before cameras in 2016. Now, Ronda Rousey had already by this stage as well reached out to Lisa Niemi, the widow of the late Patrick Swayze to ask for her blessing, really. Could she take on the role that Patrick Swayze, to a degree, took on as well? And she did indeed get that blessing. But Rousey was still in the midst of her UFC career. And at the end of 2015, I don't know an awful lot about UFC, so just bear with me on this. She was knocked out in a fight, which forced her to retire. Knocked, by the sounds of it, knocked very, very badly as well. And at the end of 2016, she came out of retirement, but just basically didn't last a minute of her comeback fight. And so in that period of 12 months, really, her UFC career was done. And in the midst of this as well, her Roadhouse seemed to hit the skids as well. There was no formal dissolution of it. But then also, we never heard of a writer. We never heard of a director for it. And so the project was kicked down the line again a little bit, as were around this time too plans for another RoboCop film. And I mean, that still continues to some degree of limbo. We don't know what's happened to it, but RoboCop Returns was the planned movie. Still waiting for it. Now, Roadhouse then slipped into limbo for a few years. And in 2020, what a year that turned out to be, the thinking was that a fresh sale of the studio might be on the cards as well. That the pandemic had hit MGM, as it had hit many other companies, both in the film industry and beyond the film industry. And in this case, the uncertainty around it had held up projects, the revenues were down, and talks were beginning towards the end of 2020 about seeking a brand new buyer for the studio. Now, it didn't take long for Amazon to enter the conversation, that it seemed likely that an Amazon or an Apple would be a good candidate for the MGM library and MGM going forward. And it didn't take long, actually, by the nature of these things, that in May 2021, it was announced that Amazon had acquired the MGM studio in a deal worth $8.45 billion, subject to regulatory approvals. Now, these approvals were going to be, I mean, whenever Amazon buys anything, there's always going to be some kind of conversation. But the state film studios were in, it was getting MGM at an advantageous time, I'd suggest. And so those approvals took less than a year in the end to secure. But by that point already, Amazon was looking to move on a Roadhouse project. That at the point it acquired MGM, it was fairly open about the fact that, number one, it was committed to getting films in cinemas. Amazon has made, what, a 15 film a year commitment to cinemas. Say what you like about the company, but there weren't that many firms who were suggesting they were going to put that many films in cinemas. But certainly as we came out the other side of the initial bunch of lockdowns. And so that was one. The other was, yeah, we're digging back into the brand names, that if there's a known brand, a known entity, we're going to try and resurrect it. We're going to try and get Legally Blonde moving again. And we're going to try and get this new take on Roadhouse going too. And I mean, it was revealed in November of 2021 that this was a high priority project for the firm. So it hadn't had the formal sign off. The acquisition hadn't been entirely completed, but it was expected to go through. And so at the end of 2021, it was revealed that Jake Gyllenhaal was in the frame to headline a brand new Roadhouse. He was already working on a Guy Ritchie film with Amazon as well. And I mean, the words Doug and Lyman came into the conversation as well. Doug Lyman's come up on this podcast before with films like Edge of Tomorrow and The Bourne Identity. We've had him as a guest on the podcast too. Not every Doug Lyman film is good. Some of them are terrific. There's usually some drama to do with them, and that would certainly be the case here as well. But Lyman also had to, he was about to start getting really into the nuts and bolts of a film set around Mount Everest, which hasn't, at the point of recording, come to life yet. He was also working on a film that would send Tom Cruise into space. That also, at the time of recording, hasn't come to life yet. And so the thinking was Roadhouse was going to take its place in that queue. But as it happened, as other projects fell out of that queue, well, I mean, suddenly it became more and more of a priority. And so the official green light was announced to the world in the summer of 2022. There was the headline in the trade press: Jake Gyllenhaal's Roadhouse movie, a go at Prime Video. That same announcement too didn't just confirm Jake Gyllenhaal, it confirmed Daniela Melchior, Billy Magnussen joining the cast. And Jennifer Salke, the head of Amazon Studios, gave a suitably upbeat quote with the official press release announcing the new Roadhouse. And she said, "Roadhouse is a home run for us. Not only is it a nod to fans of the original, but it is a big, fun, broad audience movie. We're thrilled to collaborate with Joel, Doug and this great cast led by Jake Gyllenhaal and for them to come together to reimagine the classic MGM film as an action-packed adventure for our global audience. Now, two things. Number one, in those initial news reports, it was actually announced as a streaming film. This will come up. Secondly, I mentioned the name Joel in that announcement. That's Joel Silver, a legendary Hollywood producer, the producer of big action movies, of Die Hards, of Hudson Hawk, of again, one we've talked about on this parish as well, but very much a big, loud action producer of the 1980s and 1990s. And he was on board to produce this as well. And so by August, we also, as well as Gyllenhaal, had Joaquin de Almeida, Darren Barnett, Kevin Carroll and J.D. Pardo. They signed on the dotted line. And then the coup, really, that Conor McGregor, another UFC star, was making the jump to acting with his first big screen role. As Deadline reported, Hollywood has been trying for some time to get into business with Conor McGregor, but he didn't just want to jump into anything. He wanted the project he made his debut in to be the right fit. And as the report went, insiders say when he got wind there was interest for him to join Roadhouse, he actually watched the film, the original film, for the first time. And after enjoying that, was game to meet to see how he would play a part in the new film. And sources added that after a meeting with Joel Silver, Conor McGregor was all in. He loved the idea of where the story was heading for the new Roadhouse and he signed on the dotted line. So again, this seemed like quite a coup. And this, I mean, after several years of gestation and a couple of false starts in August of 2022, production began on Roadhouse. This all looked fairly straightforward. Not much of a film story here, I can hear you say. The movie went to the Dominican Republic and filming would run without much in the way of drama until November 2022. Now, there would still be sequences that it needed to capture in 2023, notably in March of 2023, Jake Gyllenhaal, in a very toned state, almost as toned as me, was at the UFC 285 event in Las Vegas to shoot some additional sequences for the new Roadhouse. But we got to July of 2023, nearly a year after production was had first started, and the film was pretty much done. Now, there was a problem because July of 2023 is when the Screen Actors Guild, SAG-AFTRA, began its strike action. Now, this really, along with writer's strikes, brought Hollywood to a standstill for several months. And so the film wasn't quite completed by July of 2023. There were a few more moments it just needed to sort out. But also, it reportedly had a copyright deadline to hit, going back to the original screenwriter of the film, that there has been an increasing trend of original creators and writers of films trying to get the copyright back to their work with some degree of success. James Cameron, for instance, is set to get the rights back to The Terminator because a certain period of time has lapsed. And in the case of Roadhouse, the original screenwriter, David Lee Henry, well, he was trying to exercise his rights to get the rights back. But as I understand it, and please take this as my opinion, not as legal fact, as I understand it, the need for Amazon was to get the film completed by a certain point, and then the copyright claim that David Lee Henry was trying to exert would not be valid, that Amazon would have effectively retained its copyright over the movie. It's all a little bit muddy to my eyes, but that notwithstanding, it's important for what's about to come up. Now, there was also a controversy that hit in July 2023 because producer Joel Silver was soon to exit the movie as well under allegations of verbal abuse. Silver was also to produce a movie starring Mark Wahlberg for Amazon, which he's no longer producing either. And so he departed the project ahead of its release. There was still reportedly some ADR work to do, some dialogue recording, but I mean, the film was actually done by December of 2023, which I know this for a fact because I saw a completed version of it then. And Amazon already by this stage was said to be really happy with the new Roadhouse and was prioritising it. So it seemed like this was going quite seamlessly. Things then started to turn in January of 2024 when Doug Liman was, well, let's just say, not particularly happy that he penned an open letter about Amazon's decision to basically bypass cinemas and put the film straight onto streaming. And as such, as it was announced that Roadhouse would open the South by Southwest Festival taking place in March of 2024, Liman He basically revealed he was boycotting that premiere. He was boycotting the promotion to the film. And I mean, to quote some of his open letter, he said, "When Roadhouse opens the South by Southwest Film Festival, I won't be attending. I can't think of another time, actually. I've been doing this podcast a long time where a film director would write an open letter of this ilk on such a high profile project, really, just ahead of its release." He wrote, "The movie is fantastic, maybe my best, and I'm sure it will bring the house down and possibly have the audience dancing in their seats during the end credits, but I will not be there." And as Lyman said, "The facts: I signed up to make a theatrical motion picture for MGM. Amazon bought MGM. Amazon said, make a great film and we will see what happens. I made a great film." Now, because contrary to their public statements, Lyman went on, "Amazon now has no interest in supporting cinemas. Amazon will exclusively stream Roadhouse on Amazon's Prime. Amazon asked me and the film community to trust them and their public statements about supporting cinemas. And then they turned around and are using Roadhouse to sell plumbing fixtures." Now, at this stage, Amazon had pretty much kept its word in putting films onto the big screen that it had backed. I mean, it didn't necessarily always give them a very big release, but still, it had made a thing of saying, we're going to put films in cinemas and using an assortment of theatrical partners. I mean, look at the Ben Affleck movie Air, which went through Warner Brothers, I think. It was putting these films into cinemas. It did it with Saltburn as well. But the thing is, there was disagreement even on the Roadhouse team that Jake Gyllenhaal, around this time as well, would give an interview to Total Film. And he said, "I adore Doug's tenacity. And I think he's advocating for filmmakers and film in the cinema and theatrical releases. But I mean," he said, "Amazon was always clear that it was streaming." Now, Amazon was quite bullish in its defence of Roadhouse, and by mid-February, Variety had obtained what looked like quite detailed information over how the new Roadhouse filmmakers were given a choice at the point of commencement of the project. And as Variety reported, the filmmakers and Gyllenhaal were given this choice: a $60 million budget and a theatrical release, an $85 million budget and a streaming release. And they chose the latter. Now, that's an odd one to me, because I would have thought that's kind of inverted. 85 million gets you a theatrical and a streaming release, I would have thought. But what do I know? I mean, it's shortchanging the fact that it costs a lot to distribute and market a film. I understand that. But Amazon marketed the hell out of Roadhouse anyway. But then, in the midst of all this going on, another grenade gets lobbed into the Roadhouse 2024 story, because in February of 2024, the story hit that during the actor strike of 2023, when post-production was being conducted on the film, Amazon was alleged to have used artificial intelligence techniques to do some of that dialogue recording. Actors were on strike, and the implication, which Amazon firmly denied, was that instead of bringing in actors, it had used some degree of generative AI to produce the voice work for the film. And as per Variety, R. Lance Hill, the screenwriter of the original film, he used the pen name David Lee Henry, had filed a lawsuit against Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios and its parent company Amazon Studios for copyright infringement. Now, this goes back to his attempt to reclaim the copyright for the film. And in the filing that Variety had obtained, Hill claims, quote, "Amazon ignored his ability to reclaim the rights for his 1986 screenplay as they mounted a remake starring Jake Gyllenhaal. The suit goes on to allege that Amazon ignored his claims and proceeded with the film using artificial intelligence to replicate the voices of actors for ADR, additional dialogue recording, during the SAG strike in an effort to complete the film before the November the 10th deadline." Variety said that was the deadline when apparently copyright would revert. Again, Amazon denied this strongly. All of this drama meant that, I mean, it was almost having a degree of Streisand effect to it, that people who weren't aware of Roadhouse were suddenly looking at Roadhouse. I mean, if you believe the whole adage, there's no such thing as bad publicity, Roadhouse had suddenly become, even though it's going nowhere near a cinema screen, one of the most talked about films of 2024. And that was before anyone had saw it. So in March of 2024, the film did indeed make its debut at the South by Southwest Festival. And Doug Liman's words, to be fair, were right. This was a big screen movie. And on the whole, it was really well received. And I mean, I must admit, I was a fan of this. And I think Conor McGregor's performance, notwithstanding the fact it's clearly coming from a completely different film to the one everyone else was making, is pretty memorable stuff. Now, in fact, after that screening at South by Southwest, McGregor's manager passed out. And again, I mean, fortunately, McGregor's manager was fine. But it was more headlines. It was more noise about this film that Amazon was putting out into the world. And what do you know, at that premiere as well, Doug Liman did indeed turn up. In fact, there's YouTube footage, behind the scenes stuff of him going along. Not official Amazon stuff, I should note, but he was there and he got a standing ovation as well. And the reviews of the film were, well, not Liman's best movie. I think we're in the world of like Swingers and Edge of Tomorrow and things like that for the top end Doug Liman. But the critics were happy with it. I mean, a cult movie now became a good modern cheesy action film. Lots of bashing. Gyllenhaal was, I mean, Gyllenhaal in fine form in the lead role as well. And I mean, just good fun. I mean, the kind of film that's easy to criticise. Some people did criticise it, but the thinking was, I mean, this was about as good as a Roadhouse remake was going to get, and actually really quite enjoyable as well. So March 21st, Amazon put it on its Prime Video service, and I mean, it couldn't have been happier with what happened next, because I mean, we're not in the world where I can give box office figures for a streaming release, of course, and we have to trust the numbers that are given by the likes of Amazon and Netflix and such like for how many eyeballs are on their films that they put on their own streaming services. There aren't really third-party monitoring services that have the access to give you really insightful data there. Amazon, though, was banging the drum that it was the most watched original movie for the studio ever, it was saying, with 50 million global viewers in the film's first 2 weeks on the Prime Video service. And it was talked about a lot. I mean, I don't know that many people who weren't watching it around the time. And Amazon clearly had a massive hit on its hands, absolutely delighted with it. And so Liman gave an interview to Casey Neistat on his YouTube channel. And this is where we see Liman going to the premiere of the film. And he conceded in the end that in the midst of all of this, he hadn't come out particularly well. And he says, "You know, it's tough to do," he says, "but sometimes you just have to acknowledge that you lost. You took on Amazon, you fought for your movie." Liman said, "I literally did everything in my power to get this movie into theatres and I lost. So on to the next. If this is going to be literally the only screening," he's on about the South by Southwest premiere, "where people can buy tickets and go see the movie, then I want to be there." Which is why he toddled along to that premiere. And he said, "It's so much frigging work to make a movie." He did use the word frigging as well. He said, "The payoff is when you get to show it when it's all done." And he says, "I hate clucking, losing." He didn't say clucking. "I mean, I'm not a good loser and I very publicly lost here." But he did make a big hit movie, just not in by quite the metric that he would have liked. Amazon, though, very, very happy. So happy, in fact, that it's now signed Jake Gyllenhaal up to a 3-picture first look deal for his future projects. Whether Doug Liman goes back to the world of Amazon, I can't imagine that's going to happen in a hurry. But the studio has found a model here, and don't be surprised if it continues to raid its back catalogue, if it continues to bring in filmmakers and throw money at these things and hope that they land. And then don't be surprised too if occasionally they go nowhere near the inside of a cinema. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, you can get more from me on Twitter at Simon Brew. I'm on Blue Sky at Simon Brew as well. Film Stories is on Twitter and Blue Sky at Film Stories. It's on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. It's on Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. Film Stories Magazine UK on Instagram. We are, I mean, the Patreon again is patreon.com/Simon Brew. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that's where our magazines and Blu-rays are for sale. Thank you to everyone who's supporting them there. We had such an influx and I can't tell you how appreciated it is. And then we are trying to make a clickbait free entertainment website at filmstories.co.uk. clickbait free, trying to avoid all those articles like everything you need to know and blah 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 blah. We're just trying to do it the old-fashioned way. It means that occasionally we suffer in the Google algorithms and stuff like that. any support, any spreading the word, much appreciated, because this is a drum we are going to continue to bang. We don't use AI on it either. That's a whole rant for a pub. I think that's enough, though. I've outstayed my welcome as usual. I'm going to go off and watch another bunch of films now. The main thing is, you will stay well, you will keep healthy. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Until then, take care, look after yourselves, and bye-bye.